Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Gail Harris. Coming up, who's calling the shots in the Bush administration? The president supports banning some U.S. allies from contracts to rebuild Iraq, but did the policy's announcement catch him off guard?
And deep in Bush country, a Democrat wins big. Lessons for the Democratic presidential nominee in 2004?
I think there's a big center in American politics right now that is looking for champions. And I think that center is up for grabs.
Also, why it's not too late to fight the flu.
These stories and Rock Masters Remastered, Bruce Springsteen and Led Zeppelin and New York Rock Legends Television, reborn on stunning new CDs, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The White House today defended a decision to restrict access to Iraq reconstruction contracts to businesses from countries that are supporting the war. The decision is being criticized by officials in France, Germany, Russia, and Canada, which have all been excluded from bidding on the Iraqi contracts. NPR's Pam Fessler reports from the White House.
The Bush administration has come under fire from a number of countries, such as Canada, France, Germany, and Russia, for excluding them from a list of nations allowed to bid on major reconstruction contracts. But the president said the policy makes sense.
It's very simple. Our people risk their lives. A friendly coalition, folks, risk their lives, and therefore the contracting is going to reflect that. And that's what the U.S. taxpayers expect.
The president's envoy, former Secretary of State James Baker, is scheduled to visit France, Germany, Italy, Russia, and Great Britain next week to ask them to forgive Iraq's debts. The president said the United States would be grateful for any such action, but he would not say if it would then make those countries who oppose the war eligible for the reconstruction work. Pam Fessler, NPR News. The White House.
A U.S. Army base in the Iraqi town of Ramadi was attacked today. A military spokesman says an explosive charge was set off outside the entrance of the base. No deaths have been reported, but the military says there are reports of casualties. Ramadi is about 60 miles west of Baghdad. The area has been a hotbed of anti-American sentiment and the site of repeated attacks against U.S. troops. Federal officials with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say the flu has become a significant problem in 24 states. Flu has sickened people in all 50 states, and the season has yet to reach its peak. The outbreak is particularly bad in western states where vaccine supplies have been used up. In many states, several schools have already closed for the rest of the week because of the large number of students who have the flu. Federal education officials are warning college students it's never too early to start taking steps to avoid identity theft. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
The Education Department worries that college students could be easy targets because of the amount of time they spend online, doing everything from making purchases to checking their grades and assignments. Education Secretary Rodney Page says college students seem to be well-informed about protecting their physical safety, traveling in groups, locking up valuables, but they aren't yet focused on protecting their credit history. Identity thieves can use Social Security and credit card numbers to make purchases, open new accounts, even land a job. The department has launched a new hotline and website which offer tips for college students on how to prevent identity theft and respond if it does happen. First step, get a credit report each year and tear up unwanted credit applications before throwing them away. Carol Ann Clark-Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 56 points to 99.78. The Nasdaq is up 23 to 1927. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Commerce Department reports retail sales last month were up a strong 0.9%. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Despite fears the economy might cool off some following the third quarter when it expanded at an 8.2% annual rate, it appears consumers are keeping up their spending during the final 3 months of this year. The 0.9% rise in retail sales last month was far stronger than most analysts had expected. Car sales were up 2.5%. Sales at electronic stores also posted strong gains. The government also revised upwards its October sales figures from what had originally been a decline. The strong retail sales numbers come as good news for the nation's retailers and should ease worries about consumers reining in their spending. Sales at the retail level are closely watched by analysts since consumer spending is responsible for roughly two-thirds of all U.S. economic activity. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
AT&T has announced plans to extend to consumers the service it's already offering business customers. From now on, residential users can get phone service over the Internet. The service will begin in major U.S. markets early next year. Regional phone companies such as Qwest Communications and Verizon recently announced they will offer voice services, too, using the Internet. Cable TV providers have also offered Internet phone service. The technology sends voice and data traffic over Internet-based networks on high-speed lines. The insurance fund that covers investors if their brokerage firm goes under is warning about a new fraud scheme that steals identities of brokerage houses and bilks money from investors. Scam artists have created a website that uses the name of a brokerage firm but leads the potential investor to a different Internet address. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris in for Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush stood firm today on a controversial U.S. policy to exclude U.S. allies who haven't sent troops to Iraq from bidding for reconstruction contracts there. But according to today's New York Times, officials in France, Germany, and Russia are not the only ones unhappy about the announcement. White House officials are said to be upset about the timing and wording of the Pentagon memorandum outlining the policy. Joining us on the line is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for being with us, David.
Thank you very much, Gail. Good to be here.
You are reporting out of the White House that a lot of people are fuming there about the timing of this announcement about the military contracts, and that the president in particular was not happy about having to work the phones asking for debt relief as the story was breaking. What are you hearing today?
Well, this was classic left-hand, right-hand thing. On the one hand, the White House had completely signed off on the policy. And the policy is, if you're not in the coalition, you're not getting prime contracts. You can get subcontracts, but not the most lucrative prime contracts. And that had been set for some time. What I think took them by surprise were two things. First, that this thing got posted on the Defense Department website only a day before the president was scheduled to make calls to the leaders of France, Germany, and Russia, asking them to receive James Baker, the former Secretary of State and Treasury Secretary, who is going out to be the president's personal envoy on the questions of debt relief for Iraq. And the second thing was that the wording of the memo was not subtle. It said that the United States was doing this for national security purposes, excluding other countries from the contracts. Now, that wording was probably adopted for reasons of avoiding trade sanction law, but of course it was read around the world as, what, we aren't your allies?
Well, David, you have to wonder, don't these people talk to each other? How could they not have known when this announcement was coming out?
Great question, Gail. I wish I knew the answer.
And you're not going to go there. Okay. So what do we know about how those phone calls went? It certainly couldn't have been an easy conversation.
Well, one of the wonders of the way the White House does readouts, as we call them, on the president's telephone calls, is that they will tell you sometimes what it is that the president said, and they'll never tell you what the other leader said, because they say that's for that leader's government to discuss if they want to. So we don't really have a sense right now of what was said, although it certainly must have been an interesting telephone call to be listening to. One would assume that the president, realizing the headlines yesterday morning about these contracts, decided to preempt the conversation by explaining the policy. But that's only an assumption.
Well, let's look at it from another perspective. Is it possible that this is some sort of good cop, bad cop routine so that Jim Baker can now fly into Europe and smooth the ruffled feathers and perhaps show more progress than might otherwise have been the case?
Well, it could be, but when I raised that question yesterday, people in the White House were suggesting that that was giving the administration more credit than it may be due in this in this case. However, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw policy in motion here. In other words, if Jim Baker went out there and said, you know, if you act to forgive Iraq's debt, that is a political act in support of the coalition. So you might suddenly be redefined as one of these now 63 coalition members. And by yesterday evening, you saw the Pentagon spokesman hurriedly coming out and calling around to a few reporters and saying, you know, this list of 63 isn't written in stone. It can, of course, be expanded in the future. And I think that they see that as their way out of this problem.
Well, David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
David Sanger is White House correspondent for The New York Times. After a decade in office, Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien steps down tomorrow. Paul Martin, who won widespread support from the governing Liberal Party, will take over. And already Martin is reacting to Washington's decision that bars Canadian bids on those lucrative Iraqi reconstruction contracts. At a news conference yesterday, the Prime Minister-elect cited Canada's contributions to the war on terror.
Canada's put in close to $300 million in terms of the reconstruction of Iraq. We have troops in Afghanistan and are carrying a very, very heavy load in that country.
Martin told reporters he found the U.S. decision very difficult to fathom. Antonia Maione is the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. She joins us on the line from Montreal. Welcome, Antonia.
Thank you.
Remind us what Canada's position was, both during and before the war, and also what it is now.
Canada's position on the Iraq conflict was that the government would have preferred a multilateral position on any intervention in Iraq. And when that wasn't forthcoming, the Canadian government's decision was not to support the U.S., not to become part of the coalition of the willing. However, the Canadian government had at the ready troops in the area. There was Canadian engagement or at least presence in Afghanistan. So it was not that Canada was not a supporter of the war on terror in general. It was simply that on the Iraq question, the government felt that there was need for a multilateral engagement and not a unilateral one.
Hmm. Now, would Canadian companies have been high on the list of competitors for these contracts, or is this somewhat moot?
Well, the companies themselves say they wouldn't have been. This tempest is in a teapot is really one of optics. It's the idea that Canada was left out, if you will, of the countries that would be given these contracts. And so even though Canada might not have been high on the list, the idea was it's the symbolism of Canada again being, in effect, not really seen as part of the U.S.'s coalition, but also that Canada doesn't rate, if you will, as one of the countries that the United States would like to engage in closer relationships with.
Give us a sense of what the relationship between Chrétien and the United States has been and how Martin's might be different.
Well, Jean Chrétien actually had a very good relationship with Bill Clinton. The real shift in the relationship, in fact, has come with the Bush administration. And so the Bush administration and the Liberal government in Ottawa do not see eye to eye on a number of matters, including the Iraqi conflict, but also other things like softwood lumber and a lot of trade issues in which there's growing tension between Canada and the United States.
And so now Martin wants to improve relations with the Bush administration?
Paul Martin has said that this is one of the top issues on his agenda, is to think about how to better that relationship, both in terms of Canada's objectives vis-a-vis the United States, but also in having the United States understand better, perhaps, Canada's positions on a number of issues, including the Iraqi conflict.
Well, Paul Martin is somebody who has been standing ready to take over the helm for quite some time and hasn't been able to until now. Do you see his as an activist administration?
Activist in the sense of energy, yes. There's a lot of energy in this new team. The new cabinet will be unveiled on Friday. The sense of excitement is in the air, if you will. But one of the problems is that the level of expectations is so high that there's nothing Paul Martin can do, I think, that will please everyone. Everyone seems to be so energized by this change, and everyone seems to have all kinds of expectations about this new government that it's almost impossible, I think, for Paul Martin's team to meet all of those expectations.
Thank you, Antonia.
Thank you, Gail.
Antonia Maione is director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. She joined us from Montreal.
Deep in the heart of Texas may be where Democrats interested in winning the White House again should turn their attention, focusing specifically on the city of Houston, where a Democrat's been elected mayor right there in President Bush's home state. What was Bill White's secret? Well, we have Mayor-elect Bill White on the line, and Mayor, welcome to you.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on.
This was the most expensive race in Houston mayoral electoral history. How much did the money have to do with it? You had more money than anybody else. Is that the secret?
Oh, I don't think so. I ran against two people who'd been running for mayor forever, both of which had run before and come within 2 points of winning. I hadn't run for public office, so we had a little advantage, financial advantage. I put in a little money early on, and then we found this outpouring of volunteers and contributors who had never participated in mayoral elections before, and ultimately votes from citizens who just wanted to see a change and wanted to see somebody who they could identify with elected mayor.
Mayor White, some are saying that the Democratic contenders for the nomination for president aren't speaking enough about issues, that debates tend to deteriorate into talking about, for example, Al Gore's endorsement of Howard Dean, and issues get short shrift. What do you think about that criticism of the campaign so far?
The people that I ran against and the person in the runoff brought up party a lot and party labels. I was chairman of the Democratic Party of Texas. But I kept on talking about the issues of that affect people, and also the fact that when in my business career, I've always run businesses well, efficiently for the customers. And so that combination just swamped the partisanship on the other side.
I'm going to bring up money again. You spent $2.3 million of your own. You raised another $6 million from contributors. What about money, though? It matters.
Well, money matters, but remember, Houston is bigger than 16 states. Hmm. So, compared to the size of these gubernatorial and senatorial campaigns we see so often, this was pretty small potatoes. Most of what we did was grassroots. That was really the key. We had people knocking on over 100,000 doors twice. So it was a grassroots-oriented effort. And in my case, it was particularly important to have some financial backing because the person who I beat by almost a 2-to-1 margin had spent almost $4 million plus soft money running for mayor just a couple of years ago. So money wasn't the difference. The fact that we were able to raise so much money in small donations was an indicator that there was a civic movement out there.
Just to finish up, Mayor-elect, how do the Democrats defeat President Bush in November of 2004? What advice would you give to whoever the nominee is?
Mainstream candidates who talk about the issues, who convince the taxpayers that they know it's the taxpayers' money, not the government's money, and who are plain-spoken and sincere and owned by no one, have a real shot. I think there's a big center in American politics right now that is looking for champions, and I think that center is up for grabs.
Bill White is the mayor-elect of Houston, Texas. Bill White, thank you so much for joining us.
You take care.
Just ahead, human rights in Iraq. Was Hussein's ouster a triumph or an opportunity for new abuses?
And later in the show, we talk to a pediatrician about the advantages and risks of the nasal flu vaccine.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Was the downfall of the brutal regime of Saddam Hussein a triumph for those who care about human rights, or is it far from as simple as that? And in fact, could the preemptive war in Iraq mean only more instability in the world and more assaults on human rights? Well, we're joined now by John Shattuck, who served in the Clinton administration as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, and whose new book is called Freedom on Fire: Human Rights Wars and America's Response. Welcome, John.
Glad to be here.
John, I was struck when I was looking at your book. I went to the back of your book, and I was looking at the chronology. And the first entry in the chronology, which kind of takes us through the human rights landscape for all those years in the 90s when you were so involved in it all, the first entry is 1989, when the last East German trying to get over the Berlin Wall was killed. That was a time when there seemed to be a kind of springtime for human rights. The Soviet Union, a human rights violator, was falling apart. Oppressive regimes in Eastern Europe were falling apart. Just reel back for me a bit. Before your involvement with the Clinton administration, there was a sense that human rights were going to progress. And then, in fact, in the years you were an assistant secretary of state for human rights, 6 million civilians killed in civil wars, civilians. What happened?
It was an extraordinary time in 1989 to 91. And it was a time that looked like the great flowering of human rights, perhaps the greatest moment in 50 years in human rights, not only in Central and Eastern Europe, but, of course, in South Africa, the end of apartheid, et cetera. And unleashed were forces of integration that looked as if they were going to bring the world closer together, greater democracy, more human rights. And what was overlooked, and I quickly came to confront, were the forces of disintegration, which we have come to know very well. And they were the result of states failing, like Yugoslavia, that split apart, that then entered into ethnic conflict, ethnic, racial, and religious differences that were fanned into flames by people like Slobodan Milosevic, who used that as a way of stepping forward into power. And we saw that in a number of parts of the world. And I don't think the world woke up to that soon enough. The first great crisis was in Somalia, and then when Black Hawk Down, when the 18 American soldiers were killed in 1993 in a peacekeeping operation, there was a tremendous outcry against the kind of peacekeeping work to stop the forces of disintegration. Then there resulted what I call the perfect human rights storm, the catastrophic events in Rwanda 6 months later, when the U.S. essentially led the way, certainly without the participation of people at my level, because it happened very quickly, in taking out the peacekeepers because of the fear that they were going to once again be affected the way they were in Somalia.
And yet just a couple of years later, here we were dropping bombs in Serbia to end the situation there.
Well, the good news, if you can look for good news out of catastrophe, and that often happens in the human rights field, is that we learned from Rwanda, I think, and we learned that it was important to our national security interest as well as our moral interests to stop genocide, that we had to develop a new doctrine of humanitarian intervention, and it had to be a doctrine which was diplomacy backed by force.
John, human rights is such an emotional issue. A photograph of someone who's been abused somewhere can ignite emotions in all of us. Does that make it a particularly difficult way to conduct foreign policy, that there's so much emotion involved in it?
Well, I think channeling the emotion that's involved is important, to be sure. It is in our interests to try to stabilize portions of the world before it is so expensive. It cost us $25 billion in humanitarian assistance and peacekeeping assistance from about 1989 to 96. You mentioned before that there were 6 million lives lost by people inside their own countries. Whole portions of the world, like Central Africa or Southeastern Europe, Central Asia, were destabilized by these human rights wars. So the pictures sometimes will capture the attention of policymakers, but even more important is the larger set of issues, economic, security, as well as moral, that we have in addressing these human rights concerns.
This is a monumental change in approach from an American administration, from one to the next, from Clinton to Bush.
Yes, it is. And I don't want to idealize the Clinton administration by any means. My book is quite critical of decisions that were made, particularly early on in the Clinton administration, that resulted in failures to stop
foot-dragging and...
Yes. And I think the American public was not really awakened to these forces of disintegration. It took 9/11 to wake them to that. Now, tragically, I feel that while everyone is awakened to the catastrophes that are out there, we have a leadership that is essentially going about it in a way that doesn't remember the lessons from the 1990s, which is you must do these things in multilateral fashion. They take a great deal of planning. And if you're serious about humanitarian intervention, you better be clear that there is an ongoing genocide or major crimes against humanity, and not have as an afterthought that this is an intervention for human rights reasons.
Does it frustrate you now to see the policy, we will strike at anyone we think could possibly threaten us?
Well, I tell you what really troubles me the most. I fear that the next time there is a real genocide in progress, as there was in Rwanda, as there was in Bosnia, that the American people will not have the stomach for the kind of humanitarian intervention that must be undertaken as a result of the events in Iraq. That is my greatest fear, that we have essentially substituted a complicated and developing doctrine of humanitarian intervention. We've substituted for that this doctrine of preemptive unilateral war. It's gone badly in Iraq. People are concerned about it. They're not going to want to do this again soon. And that is very troublesome. It will, frankly, take a whole different approach to get them to do it.
John Shattuck, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Shattuck is currently Chief Executive Officer of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation in Boston, and he's author of the book, Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Europe's fight over God. Should God be mentioned in the new EU Constitution? And should kids wear religious garments to school?
Also tomorrow, the influence and opinions of late Wall Street Journal editor Robert Bartley.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Al-Qaeda could be moving to a new front in Iraq. Osama bin Laden allegedly tells his fighters to join Iraqi insurgents and kill Americans.
This does seem to be much more of the kind of thing that, you know, skeptics of the war and even CIA officials warned about before the war, which was that this could indeed drive them into bed with each other.
And pop critic Tim Riley's picks for the holidays, remasters of old rock masters.
It was such a fertile creative period back there in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that we're still discovering a lot of this material that's been buried.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. The number of states hit hard by the flu has nearly doubled since last week and includes almost the entire western half of the country. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which adds that the season has not even peaked yet nationally. At least 11 children have died in the outbreak. The CDC is trying to redistribute what's left of flu vaccinations and is considering buying additional doses from a British firm. The U.S. military is investigating today's suicide attack on the 82nd Airborne Division in the Iraqi town of Ramadi. Lourdes Navarro is in Baghdad.
According to a military spokesman, a suicide bomber detonated an explosives charge just outside a U.S. Army base in Ramadi at about 1:30 p.m. local time. There are reports of some casualties at the Army's Champion base, but no reports of deaths among U.S. troops. The military says three Iraqis who were in a car were killed. An investigation is underway. Ramadi is in an area to the west of Baghdad where U.S. forces have faced many attacks. Suicide bombers have made a number of assaults on U.S. bases in recent weeks, and while causing many injuries, no American soldiers, though, have been killed. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
In France, a proposal to ban Islamic headscarves and other religious attire is moving forward. A blue-ribbon panel commissioned by the president says the ban would be a way to counter what it calls destabilizing forces in France. But some Christian and Jewish leaders are against the proposal and favor better integration of the Muslim community. The World Food Program estimates that nearly 4 million North Koreans could go without critical food aid by the end of the winter. The UN agency says 2 million people are already missing deliveries because of global cutbacks on donations. The UN says it expects to deliver only 62% of what it originally requested this year. The food shortfall comes amid a standoff over North Korea's nuclear weapons programs. New government figures are indicating the economy is moving in a positive direction. The figures show retail sales jumped by nearly a full percentage point last month and are up by close to 7% from November of last year. Government figures also show jobless claims were down for the 10th consecutive month. On Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 63 points and the Nasdaq ahead 24. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
As the insurgency in Iraq began several months ago now, President Bush famously said about the forces attacking U.S. troops, bring them on. Well, they have kept coming at American soldiers and U.S. allies relentlessly ever since. And Osama bin Laden's reportedly now decided more than ever to take President Bush's challenge by pulling hundreds of his fighters from Afghanistan onto the shadowy front lines in Iraq. Newsweek has a report on this in its latest issue. One of the reporters is Michael Hirsch, who joins me now. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Michael, first, the U.S. can't catch Osama bin Laden, despite, I think, a $25 million price on his head at this point. How is it that Newsweek has strong enough intelligence to know what he plans to do next?
Interesting question. Wesley Clark asked just that question on the campaign stump. One of our reporters has terrific sources in the Taliban. He operates, our reporter does, out of Pakistan. And what we've discovered in Pakistan is that Taliban are moving around fairly freely.
Your reporter spoke to someone called Sharifullah, which is a nom de guerre.
Right. It's not his real name. It's one he uses. But we know this source quite well. He has provided us with accurate reporting on previous stories. And he has acted as a translator for meetings between bin Laden and Mullah Omar, the ousted Taliban leader.
So what does Osama bin Laden plan to do, Michael?
Well, according to our sources, there was a meeting in mid-November during Ramadan when representatives of bin Laden met in an undisclosed location with Taliban delegates and told them that bin Laden had decided he was going to move a substantial portion of his remaining manpower and money resources to Iraq. He saw that as a great opportunity to kill Americans.
Now, couldn't this just be bravado? What does U.S. intelligence say about all this?
U.S. intelligence tends to play down the report. We did talk to them. They suggest that al-Qaeda simply doesn't have the resources. But I must say that, you know, frankly, the record of the CIA on these kinds of issues recently has not been that good.
Yeah.
And clearly what we saw in October is bin Laden issued another call for holy war in the Mideast. And so there is the question of whether or not Islamists and jihadists are responding to his call.
And your sources indicate we're talking about hundreds of jihadists.
According to our sources, bin Laden wants to send about a third of those to Iraq, apparently via the land route through Iran, which acts as a sort of connecting station between Central and South Asia and Iraq. The problem is, of course, that Bush is quite eager to tamp down the insurgency in Iraq, which until now has been mainly domestic, local, you know, Saddam loyalists and Fedayeen.
Yeah.
And now the question is, you know, is this generally going to become the central front in the war on terror?
Osama bin Laden's fighters tend to specialize in attacking soft targets. They kill civilians. They haven't gone up against a real army all that often, let alone an army with tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles and attack jets and all the rest of the unparalleled U.S. military machine. Any sense how that would work?
Yeah, well, I think we've already seen to some degree how it would work, because the Iraqi insurgency in Iraq has targeted military convoys, soldiers. We've seen that for months now. And that does seem to be a somewhat different thing from what we've seen in these recent attacks in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, which seem to be more traditionally al-Qaeda. So the real nightmare now, I think, is that you could have a real alliance of convenience between the Iraqi insurgents and the al-Qaeda-generated terrorists, which should just cause a huge headache for the American occupation in Iraq and the American presence in the Mideast.
And the sense is that's a new relationship, not, as the Bush administration has alleged, an old relationship between Saddam and al-Qaeda.
Well, you know, we have checked this out. It does seem to be new. This does seem to be much more of the kind of thing that, you know, skeptics of the war and even CIA officials warned about before the war, which was that this could indeed drive them into bed with each other.
Michael Hirsch is a senior editor for Newsweek and part of the team who wrote this week's piece on al-Qaeda redirecting its attention to Iraq. Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
A Massachusetts teenager and a 6-year-old North Carolina boy are the latest casualties of this year's flu season. Even as public health officials urge people to get vaccinated against influenza, doctors say they're out of vaccine and admit that this year's vaccine might not protect against the Fujian A strain of virus that has struck hard in some western states. Sean Palfrey is a pediatrician specializing in public health at the Boston Medical Center. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
And tell us first, is there any vaccine available at this point?
There are two forms of vaccine right now. One of them is given by shot, and this is the one that is in very short supply at this point. Some doctors' offices, some hospitals have some supplies, perhaps a few boards of health in local towns and cities have small numbers. But this is the vaccine that we're giving to children and adults at risk for flu. And we're trying to save as much of that to give the children and adults who have asthma or heart disease or diabetes or some other kind of chronic illness or immunodeficiency who cannot get the other form of vaccine. The other form of vaccine is flu mist, which is given into the nose of patients. The advantage of it is that it doesn't require a shot. There is a fair amount of it available. But the disadvantage of it is, and the irony of it is, that it's not to be given to people at risk.
So no one under 5, no one over 50. Why is this vaccine not appropriate for them?
What we found is that the children under 5 actually have more reaction to the vaccine. This is a vaccine which is actually made up of live viruses. Although they're not strong, they don't cause serious illness, they are able to make the body generate some immunity. But in the process of giving this vaccine, people will get a cold. And there are certain individuals, the little children and the older individuals, who, when they get this cold, may set themselves at greater risk.
And now this is a live virus. So if you're the parent of a child who gets this form of vaccine, you could send that child to school and they could spread it to everyone in the classroom.
Yes, there are advantages and disadvantages to that. We don't want people to give this weakened virus to people who are at very high risk. But in fact, we don't mind other people getting it who are around in the family, because this is not a form of the virus which is going to make anybody very sick except for the most high-risk individuals.
Now, so far, the flu is hitting harder in some states than others, Colorado and Texas in particular. Is this the kind of outbreak that might be limited to some regions and not spread to other areas?
It's likely to spread everywhere. The pattern of spread is typical. It tends to start in the south and west and move eastward. There have been some eastern states who are seeing quite a few cases of it. It's moved quite rapidly, and this is early for it to be hitting all of these states.
Sean, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sean Palfrey is president of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center in Boston.
Still to come, what's old is new again. Remastered rock classics from Led Zeppelin and Bruce Springsteen.
You're listening to Here and Now. The word tailgate usually conjures up images of the few guys drinking and flipping burgers out the back of their truck before a football game. Well, tailgating has come a long way in the past few years. Joining us on the line is tailgating veteran Russ Stevenson, or Tailgate Russ, as most people know him. He's the organizer of a 1,000-person tailgate party before next Monday's Philadelphia Eagles and Florida Dolphins game. And with that kind of turnout, it promises to be a tailgate party like no other. So welcome, Russ.
Hey, Gail. Thanks a lot.
What kinds of events are you going to have here?
My five keys to a big tailgate party, successful tailgate party, is people, and we surely will have that. A great facility, a lot of food. We've got a seafood station with mahi-mahi and conch fritters. We've got a barbecue station with brats and burgers and ribs. Beverages, we'll have, I don't know how many kegs we're going to go through, but I would venture to say 40 to 50 kegs. So we got the beverages covered. And then the fourth thing is the entertainment. I always have music between a DJ or a live band. And then we have Elvis. Everybody wonders where Elvis went. Well, he's going to be at a 1,000-person tailgate party on the 15th. We've got 10 masseuses. We've got a couple of clowns. And then a little added treat. I always give out goofy trophies and plaques. And then another thing we do is we always raise money for Children's Hospital. So it really has all the makings of a great tailgate party. And then we head into the game. The Dolphins and Eagles are both having good seasons, and, yeah, it should be one heck of a game.
Russ, what's in this for you? Is this a business, or is it just a fun thing to put together?
I guess to answer your question, I've always enjoyed organizing. I've always liked the big party. But a lot of work. I'm the organizer on this. So when the dust settles, you know, I probably have a little bit left over to take the family out to dinner. But it's more of a labor of love.
And how will you know if it's a success or not? Is it just a matter of numbers of how many people show up?
I'll just know by, you know, what people are saying. I mean, you know, as we walk over to the game at about 8:30, if people are high-fiving me and saying, you know, yoke tailgate rush, you're the man, then I'll know it's a success.
And do you ever have a problem with people having such a good time at the tailgate party they don't want to go to the game? Do you ever have to chase them into the stadium?
Well, actually, in Philly, I would set up a living room, and we would have seven couches and a coffee table, coat rack, oriental rug, 60-inch big-screen TV off the back of a U-Haul, and there'd probably be anywhere from 25 to 75 people that wouldn't go into the game, which was the right move sometimes because it wouldn't be that great of a game. And that's truly, you know, a tailgate party watching it from the parking lot. But on this one, everybody's got game tickets and they're all heading in.
Well, Russ, have a good time.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Russ Stevenson of Tailgate Russ and the 1,000-person tailgate party spoke to us from Philadelphia. For more information, go to our website at here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
I suspect more than a few of us woke up in the past couple of days and realized that whatever holiday you celebrate this time of year, it's coming up quicker than you thought. Thanksgiving came late this year, and that's crunched the gift-buying season. Well, for any rock music lovers on your list, help is on the way in the form of some spectacular new remasterings of old masters. We're joined now by Here and Now's pop and rock music critic, Tim Riley. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Tim. Let's first take a listen to this.
There's a code of silence that we don't dare speak. There's a wall between us and a river so deep. We keep pretending that there's nothing wrong. There's a code of silence and it can't go on.
Tim, I know who that is, but I don't know that song.
Yeah, well, this is from a new Bruce Springsteen Essentials collection, which is actually two CDs of greatest hits. It's kind of his greatest hits expanded. Uh-huh. And then a third CD of a lot of unreleased stuff, like this song, which is a live track called Code of Silence. And, of course, Springsteen wrote this track after the Amado Diallo killing and the O.J. Simpson fiasco about the code of honor, the code of blue among cops. The sound on this new greatest hits stuff is vastly improved, even since the 1995 greatest hits
Do they do that on purpose so that you got to buy the new greatest?
Oh, it's totally a cynical game of. But there are also the argument to be made is that there's now is, you know, CDs are sounding better than ever now, and it really makes you look very cynically on the past. They released CDs way too soon. Mm. They did not know how to make CDs sound very good early on. But these remasters of Springsteen songs are really going to make you hear a lot of this familiar material in very fresh ways. This song, Sandy, I think really stands out. You're hearing a lot more detail and depth and presence, and you're going to really marvel at how great he sounds from his second album.
That's a song that brings back times and places for me, and I'm sure a lot of our audience, and for you, Tim.
Yeah,
but I've never heard it like that.
Well, and it's a notoriously poorly recorded record, and the fact that they've bucked it up and made it sound so good, it sounds like he just recorded it yesterday.
That was The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle, the second album.
That's right, his second album. And so you're hearing a lot more detail and presence in those tracks that we never heard before. So if you don't have a Springsteen collection, this is definitely the one to get. There's also a DVD from Springsteen and the E Street Band called Live from Barcelona, some of which appeared on ABC Network Television last spring, and it's just simply dazzling. If you're not persuaded that this guy is the greatest living performer, this will convince you.
Now, have you got anything a little less mainstream, perhaps, than the great Bruce Springsteen?
Well, if you have any fans of alternative or punk rock in your house, I suggest three new re-releases, and these have also been remastered for beautiful sound, by one of the great new wave bands that never really made it as big as they should have. They're called Television. These have also been remastered, and the third disc sports a live set from 1978 in San Francisco that seals their legendary live reputation.
Tom Verlaine and Richard Lloyd, the two great guitarists, dueling, truly one of the great bands of the 70s.
One of the great bands, and, you know, punk was never really known for virtuoso guitar playing, and this is a band that figured out how to do it all within the punk aesthetic of not showing off.
Marquee Moon by Television, that's their great rock and roll epic, Marquee Moon. Phenomenal sound there. There's been live albums by Television before, right, Tim? But you've never heard them that clear and brilliant. Wow.
Yeah, this is really a revelation. They were a great live band, and this is a beautifully mic'd set. Yeah. And it really makes you appreciate, you know, punk really has a bad reputation in retrospect as being sort of monolithic and harsh and crude and all of that. And in reality, it really was full of variety and invention, and bands like this showed that.
And masterful musicianship.
Masterful musicianship and songcraft, too, as well. So if your kids are into Coldplay or Linkin Park, turn them on to Television, which will show you where a lot of these new bands got their props.
Ain't That Nothing by the great band Television, though they never made it as big as the next band we're about to talk about, right, Tim?
Yeah, well, this band was definitely big, and they definitely deserved it, yeah.
Take that, Coldplay. Yeah. Led Zeppelin, what was that?
Well, what can I say? That's Led Zeppelin Live from 1979 at the Knebworth Festival, and that's from the DVD. There's two Led Zeppelin Live releases this past year, both of which are really great and got surprisingly little attention given how good they are. One is a complete live set from L.A.
In the 70s.
It's a 3-CD set. And the other is a DVD that's called simply DVD, and it's two DVDs that covers three different live shows that span, you know, the key part of Led Zeppelin's career from 1970, 1973, and 1979. And so you get this really, the sense of the expanse of their career as they boomed in popularity. And one of the most charming moments on that DVD comes from their 1970 show where they come out an encore with Eddie Cochran's Something Else.
I've tended to be a little cynical, as we said before, Tim, about reissues, remasters. But, boy, these albums all seem to argue that remastering really matters.
Well, remastering now has turned into an art form. That's what Bruce Springsteen says on his collection, and his producer of that, Bob Ludwig, the guy who did the remastering on that. And it's really true, because they're finding ways to improve the sound, the original sound, and we're hearing things we never heard before. Now, the cynical vantage on all this is that, you know, they're reissuing all this stuff from their libraries, and it's very cheap for them, so they're making a lot of money on it, and they're not investing the same amount in new material, okay? But the glasses half full version of the same thing is that, you know, it was such a fertile creative period back there in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when all of these tracks that we just heard, that we're still discovering a lot of this material that's been buried. And there's so much more to go back and reinvestigate that we're really just catching up with how creative these people were.
There were so many layers to these great, great songs and so much nuance in it that you just never heard before.
That's right. And so I think we're really lucky to be getting these CDs right now.
Here and now, pop and rock critic Tim Riley. Tim, great to see you.
Thanks, Bill.
You got one to go out on?
Yeah, I thought we'd go out with one of my favorite television tracks, which is called Days.
For a list of Tim's picks, go to our website, here-now.org.
Up in the high, high hills with my bloody friend, watching all
Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Cridell, Emiko Tomagawa, Sarah Cook, Rachel Dornhelm, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now. The fight over God in Europe. Should God be mentioned in the new EU Constitution?
And the influence and opinions of the late Wall Street Journal editor, Robert Bartlett.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.